KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Or Redwood City, California.
Hayward?
Near Richmond, Richmond District, kind
of. Coming up, we'll hear how the city of San Francisco is trying to protect affordable housing from the free market.
You're not going to be able to come displace the folks at this property because we're going to put it in trust and you're never going to be able to buy it and evict everybody.
Then, how leadership change at the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development may trickle down to Bay Area households.
And HUD has a meaning far beyond housing, and Ben will be able to find that true meaning.
And Bay Area musicians on falling in love with the crazy beautiful sounds of Balkan music.
It sounds like a truck ran over your ear.
I can't wait to hear that. Stay tuned. Cross Currents is next. Cheap rental housing can feel like a vanishing resource in San Francisco. Property owners are selling buildings for far more than they originally paid, and who can blame them? But the consequence is almost all the units are getting fixed up and turned into luxury housing. It's the way of the market, and it can seem inevitable. But what if it's not? In San Francisco, the city has begun trying to preserve its existing affordable housing by buying out landlords before flippers can get to them first. It's called the Small Sites Acquisition and Rehab Program, and it just got a big boost in funding thanks to Prop C, which passed last November. Today, for the last in our series on preserving affordable housing in the Bay Area, KALW's housing and homelessness reporter Liza Veal gives us a glimpse into the program.
When San Francisco residents Rhea and Joel St. Julian had a baby, they knew they wanted to move out of their one-bedroom apartment. They were determined to stay in the city, but they couldn't find anything they could afford on social worker and artist salaries. Well, their daughter is six now. She still sleeps on a couch next to their bed. They refuse to leave the city.
We're just really stubborn.
We're very stubborn. I think we're stubborn about, like, commitment.
Yeah, we've been together for 16 years since we were teenagers, so we don't quit.
But that stubbornness just paid off. A few months ago, they heard from a friend about an opportunity to live in an apartment building that was beautiful and it was guaranteed lifetime affordable housing or something. They didn't really get it, but it sounded great.
Felt like a shot in the dark. Like, we were just like, okay, this is another opportunity that we'll try and see. And
try not to get our hopes up.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
They'd applied to lots of low-income housing lotteries, knowing that they couldn't afford anything market rate. And now, this opportunity was just one spot for one family. A long shot, but
we were like, you can't win if you don't play. Let's put in our application and see what happens.
As if touched by a miracle, they were chosen by the lottery, which meant if their finances checked out, they'd get the spot. They held their breath.
And you're like, okay, I want to make sure I do everything to take care of this precious little thing so that I don't screw this up.
Right. We didn't really tell anyone until we knew
we signed that lease.
That we signed the lease. Right. And then we were like, resisting displacement. We were so excited.
So what is this mysterious, too-good-to-be-true lifetime housing? I will explain. It's a unit in a rent-controlled building that used to be privately owned, but was bought by a nonprofit, the San Francisco Community Land Trust. Now, rents are set on a sliding scale according to residents' income. The city's begun putting up money for organizations like the Land Trust to go in and basically rescue the homes of working and middle-class people. Over the past 2 years, 22 rent-controlled buildings in San Francisco have been put into the hands of nonprofits. And when buildings are bought this way, it's the last time they will ever be bought or sold again.
This is permanent. Like, we will die in this apartment.
We'll get back to the St. Julians, but first, how is this possible?
Real estate is a very capitalistic game in San Francisco.
This is Tyler McMillan with the Community Land Trust that bought the building. They use a city loan to do it. Then they reset the rents. Most people living in these buildings were already living there. But once a unit frees up, someone moves or passes away, they can bring in a new family, like the St. Julians. The plan is about rescuing small apartment buildings that are rent-controlled, which makes them especially attractive to real estate speculators. See, they can command higher rents if they can get existing tenants out.
And so the small site strategy simply takes that opportunity at those buildings away from those folks and says, you're not going to be able to come displace the folks at this property because we're going to put it in trust and you're never going to be able to buy it and flip it and evict everybody.
The small site strategy was kicked off a couple of years ago after grassroots organizers petitioned the city to start a loan program. So nonprofits do the operations, but the city pays for the buildings and the rehab work. The rents from the tenants go toward paying that money back to the city. But remember, the rents are really low, so it'll be a while.
Folks often wonder, well, how the heck does that loan ever get paid back? Usually it's a 30-year loan that gets refinanced a number of times. And so you see the city of San Francisco really investing in the long haul. It may be 100 years until they get their money, but that's how important preserving these affordable units is to the city.
Yeah, so the city isn't making money off investing in real estate this way, and neither are the nonprofits. But eventually, if we can imagine San Francisco in a century, the buildings will be paid off, and the rents will just go towards maintenance and paying people to operate them, like Tyler McMillan of the future. So, sounds good, right? But let's spin this out. Let's talk about scale. In some countries, pretty substantial portions of the housing stock are guaranteed affordable housing, either because they're owned by nonprofits or the government. For example, in Amsterdam and Hong Kong, half of the housing is publicly owned. Currently, 10% of San Francisco is nonprofit-owned, mostly big affordable housing complexes. So how much more could come from the small sites? Well, right now, the city hopes to buy about 100 rent-controlled units per year. So at that rate, all the rent-controlled units in the city could be bought in just under 2,000 years. Why can't we do more? Buying housing is expensive. Here's Kate Hartley, the deputy director of the mayor's office of housing, who runs the loan program.
Some people have criticized the program as being expensive, but from our perspective, that extra cost is well worth it.
When she says extra cost, what she means is it actually can cost slightly more for the city to buy and rehab existing housing than to build brand new affordable housing. That's because when the city builds, they can tap into federal sources of funding. But that funding is reserved specifically for very low-income people. The Small Sites program serves a range of incomes that average out to a little below the middle. So no federal funding.
So in our Small Sites buildings, we take the tenants as we find them. Some people make, you know, good, decent salaries. Some people are on SSI, or they're disabled, or they're seniors, they're on fixed income.
Hartley says in the long run, it costs less to keep going because the higher income tenants are subsidizing the lower income tenants. And that's a subsidy that costs the city nothing.
So it's this great income mixing that at the end of the day, even though we put in, you know, slightly higher amount per unit at the beginning, it creates a financially self-sustaining model that protects really vulnerable people.
It also protects the middle income tenants that get into the sites. It might seem like middle-income people should be easier to help because they don't need as much of a subsidy, but there aren't actually many governmental policies that help them with rental housing. And Hartley says if San Francisco wants to keep its lower and middle-income residents, it needs to do something about these units. Without making an investment now to keep them, it's almost guaranteed that all the people living in them will eventually be displaced by higher-paying ones.
Eventually, our rent-controlled stock will all move to market rate rents. So it's really an ongoing loss of affordable housing.
But when the small sites program reclaims these units from the market, the city gets to hold on to residents who aren't rich, but who might enrich the city. Like, for example, social workers and artists like Joel and Rhea St. Julian.
This is the retrofitting that they're doing.
Oh my God, there's a huge backyard.
Yeah, we'll show you that too.
Joel says the social work he does with young people is more personal now. It's the future of his neighborhood, his city.
Now that I know that I'm not leaving San Francisco, there's more of a like, I'm investing in what will hopefully have last, will last and that will positively affect this community, you know, and I'm part of that. And I feel like I have a say in that.
For Rhea, the best part is living without the precariousness of being a renter in this city.
When you don't have, like, resources or trust funds or inheritances coming to you, like, you don't have a 10-year plan.
Like, you're just figuring it out as it goes. So we definitely were not thinking about old age, other than the fact that we will never retire.
Yeah, retirement wasn't an option, but I think now it's just like, we could stay here, and it changes our, I think it changes everything. It changes how we think about our family, mm-hmm. most importantly. But then also changes how we think about, like, how we want to put roots here.
Putting roots down makes a difference. When people have lifetime stable housing, they can build connections to everyone around them. This has been studied. Regardless of how poor a neighborhood is, when residents stay put for good, crime goes down, health improves, neighborhood schools perform better, and social nets keep people from falling through cracks. And that's why it's not just about the lucky ones like Rhea and Joel. It's about the whole city. For Cross Currents, I'm Liza Veal.
This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Julie Kane, in for Hanat Baba. That last story was the third in our series about preserving affordable housing in the Bay Area. Now I've got our housing reporter, Liza Veal, here in the studio with me to talk a little about how policies at the state and national level could affect housing here. Now, I know many people have the new administration on their minds.
Yes.
What does the Trump administration mean for affordable housing?
When it comes to housing, the main funding that we get from the federal government is through the Department of Housing and Urban Development.
So that's HUD, right? That funds Section 8 and public housing.
Yeah, and it also gives tax credits to fund low-income housing. So HUD has a new secretary.
Well, not quite yet. I mean, President Trump has nominated Ben Carson. He was one of last year's Republican presidential candidates, as you'll remember, but he hasn't been confirmed yet. He's a retired neurosurgeon, but he's kind of a wild card because he has no experience in housing policy.
He does have a lot of opinions, though. He's spoken out against what he calls a culture of dependency promoted by social welfare programs, which is what HUD does. And he came under some fire for saying, quote, poverty is really more of a choice than anything else. At his confirmation hearing, he was asked, what is the best possible thing we can do for someone on government assistance? And his answer was, quote, get them off it. Which is not inconsistent with the Republican stance on social spending in general.
So does that mean funding for affordable housing in the Bay Area could be cut by Ben Carson?
Not necessarily by Carson alone, but by Trump and the Republican Congress. Trump says he wants to cut all non-defense government spending, so everything but military and intelligence, by 1% every year, which people say could decimate HUD.
And that would mean fewer Section 8 vouchers, less money for public housing.
Yeah. And there are also a bunch of policies that were instituted by the Obama administration that Carson could very easily rescind or just let wither by not funding their enforcement.
Like what, for example?
The most vulnerable one is probably this one that financially incentivizes cities to desegregate by building low-income housing in neighborhoods that are economically and racially mixed. Carson has called this program a mandated social engineering scheme, meaning he thinks it's government overreach, government meddling where it doesn't belong.
So it doesn't look very good for affordable housing from the federal level. But I wonder about California. I mean, politics here are very different.
It's true. Democrats have a supermajority in the state legislature. Governor Jerry Brown says he'll put up more funding for affordable housing on one condition. If and only if lawmakers approve his plan to streamline and incentivize new housing construction statewide. He thinks that addressing the housing shortage is a prerequisite to solving the affordable housing crisis. Mm-hmm. Opponents, on the other hand, think the plan lets developers steamroll through communities. So Brown failed to get enough backers of that deal last year, but it could be made this year. And then another notable fight that's underway at the state level is this proposal to end mortgage tax breaks on vacation homes. So that means property owners only get the tax break on their first home, not any other homes. And closing just that one tax hole would generate $300 million a year that the proposal wants to use for affordable housing in California.
Wow. But it is going to cost a lot more than that to solve the housing crisis.
Yeah. Well, among housing advocates who take a different tack from Jerry Brown, who are maybe more skeptical of the free market, there's talk about drastically changing the tax system to generate more money for low-income housing. I mean, the truth is right now, taxpayers subsidize homeowners more than people who are housing insecure, who are renters or need subsidies. So to go back to the national level, the federal government spends more on mortgage tax deductions, which are the bigger the home, the bigger the deduction, than it does on all forms of housing assistance for renters combined.
Okay, but overhauling the federal tax system is kind of a long shot, right?
Yeah, especially in this administration. But these housing problems are likely only going to get more extreme. I mean, right now, for example, in Berkeley, it has the highest homeless population in the Bay Area. Nearly 10% of the population is homeless.
In Berkeley.
And the last time homelessness was this bad nationwide was during the Great Depression. And what happened then was the federal government responded with the New Deal.
Thanks, Liza. That's KALW's housing reporter, Liza Veal. To hear all the stories in our series on preserving affordable housing, head to our website, kalw.org, click Cross Currents. What stories about housing in the Bay Area would you like to hear? Let us know by emailing housing@kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Julie Kane, in for Hanat Baba. The dozen-plus members of Oakland-based Balkan brass band Inspector Gadget come from all over the world. They're serious students of Roma, sometimes known as gypsy music, but none of them are actually Roma. The group grew out of a collaboration between activist street band The Brass Liberation Orchestra and the nonprofit Voice of Roma, which works to dismantle stereotypes about Romani culture, largely through the arts. Over the last couple years, the band has been in a long-term collaboration with Roma clarinetist Ismail Luminovsky, and they're about to release their debut album together. In this edition of Bay Area Beats, band members Marco Perez Coppola, who's from Italy, and Ophir Uziel, originally from Israel, explain the band's focus on both performance and social engagement.
My name is Marco Perez Coppola, and I play percussion. In particular, the drum is called tapan.
My name is Ophir Uziel, and I play accordion, Inspector Gadget. I identify as the inspirationalist.
Can I say spiritual guide of the band?
In times of crisis. When we started forming a band, we were on a hunt on a name. So the name, we want, one of the things that we talked about is using the word gage. Gage is a word that describes a non-Romani person, an outsider. And we all international folk that play Romani music as really putting it up front that there is a relationship between inside and outsider, you know, of this cultural exchange of music. We came up with Inspector Gadget as kind of a joke, as a pun, that is allowing us to introduce first what is Gadget. And there is all these nuances again with this character, like there is policemen that trying really clumsily solve the problem of the world and constantly fail, but is like a symbol of good intentions. And
there's also the inspection aspect. So we're inspecting this music, this culture. Thus, Inspector Gadget.
We have been studying with Roman Salishopov and other masters as well as Ishmael Lumanovsky, that other musicians that we able to have a cross-cultural learning. The master teach you it by playing with you. So you really collaborate on a version that is working right now. This is the 21st century when digital music and traditional music and multicultural perspectives all come together. So you hear it, nuance of modernity in a traditional song. We may play in an arrangement of an old song written maybe like 60 years ago in a little village in Bulgaria, and we play with the same similar instruments, and the dancers are, you know, maybe symbolic to this music, but there's nuance of here and now growing music.
So one of my favorite songs on the album is called Chocek America, written by a Bulgarian clarinet player named Sally Oka. And Ismail takes apart his G clarinet and only plays half of the G clarinet and makes it sound like a complete different instrument. So if you were to hear this recording, you would never think it was a clarinet. It sounds like a truck ran over your ear. It's imitating the dzurna, which is the loudest instrument I've ever heard. It's a beautiful, overwhelming sound.
Let's say that both of us, I think, are street musicians in a sense. That we got our inspiration and education and the exposure being there in the streets. When you play on the streets, you're really in this really direct interaction with the muse, with the consciousness of people, with what's going on, whatever the weather, whatever the political time, whatever the struggle. So you really conjure that. So we both bring it to the band because this music is played in ceremonial, in the streets, one-to-one, you know, for dance, for interaction. He brings it very well through the drum and the managing, bringing together everybody, metaphysically with the sounds, but also like logistically, works really hard to just connect constantly. And I'm just with the accordion, try to push buttons and to see what happens.
And we also do the opposite. We, you know, we bring the street to the band, but also we bring the band to the street.
The track number 11, Ismail Taksim, it's a short piece, but it's a taksim, which is a specific part of a song in the beginning that is kind of a invocation part. So it has a drone, which is a harmonic note, right, harmonized with like few note musicians playing instruments and just giving a support for a soloist to improvise and introduce the thematic elements for the song to come. Ishmael does incredible work there, and it's a very special moment.
We use this moment in the show to give everybody a breather from jumping up and down, but also to look within yourself. As outsiders and musicians, we definitely keep in mind the aspects of cultural appropriation that can benefit both cultures but also hurt one culture in particular.
We're talking about populations that were suffer from discrimination and racism for hundreds of years, and right now we're seeing certain festivals that are really high-end festivals that consume the exoticness of certain culture, but the actual culture doesn't benefit anything from that. And oftentimes they suffer from the other end. I think Marco and I, we see how musicians dedicate their life to the art and the study. And it's, which really takes a collaboration between two ends. You cannot just study through YouTube or just study by yourself. There is a direct reaction, you know, when you go out to the streets, when you go to the performance, when you deal with other musicians. So when musicians are using their music with a good intention and constantly growing and giving credits to their journey and really support the sources, this is the good way of kind of doing it right.
That was Marco Perez Coppola and Ophir Uziel from the Balkan brass band Inspector Gadje. That piece was produced by KALW's Ted Muldoon. Inspector Gadje will be celebrating their album release with clarinetist Ismail Luminovsky at the Rickshaw Stop in San Francisco this Saturday night. They're offering two pairs of free tickets for KALW listeners. To win yours, call 415-841-4134 and leave your name and number. CrossCurrents team includes Leela Day, Nina Gensler-Debs, Olivia Henry, Angela Johnston, Jeremy Ju, Jürgen Klemm, Lisa Morehouse, Ted Muldoon, James Rowland, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, Carrie Spivak, and Andrew Stelzer. The show was engineered by Chris Haw. Today's line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Julie Kane.